and talk for a minute, and then I'll listen in on what we've gotten. This is Leon Gortler interviewing Charles Price at the University of Pennsylvania on April 29th, 1979. This is our second interview meeting. Before I go any further, you mentioned your grandmother and the influence she had on you, but we never mentioned her name. Tell me your grandmother's
name. My grandmother's name was Sarah Shoemaker Farley.
Okay. I just thought that was important for the record to... Okay. Repeat just a little bit of it. Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize.
Well, one of my assignments in the war was to learn about the... to try to ascertain the chemistry of the behavior of sulfur mustard in water, with the aim partly of finding out the, how to analyze for it. And in order to do that, we needed to know exactly what the mechanism of the hydrolysis was.
Okay, hold up.
So I did a lot of reading about this. There was a modest amount of stuff in the literature, because of course sulfur mustard had actually been used in World War I, and it was clear that the reaction was a simple first order reaction. It was, but the products of the reaction were determined by the nature of nucleophiles in the solution. You could hydrolyze mustard and water pure, and you got a half-life of 8 minutes. You put thiosulfate in, you change the product completely to the thiosulfate replacement product, exactly the same half-life. People had interpreted that, wrote it in the literature, as though it went through a carbonium ion intermediate, and called it an SN1 reaction. And that just didn't wash with me. I just could not believe that a carbonium ion could be that selective with what it's going to react with. There's no evidence that the tertiary butyl carbonium was anywhere near that selective, for example, benzyl carbonium. So it just seemed totally wrong to me that it was a carbonium ion, but it took me a few weeks of thinking about it before it finally dawned on me. As I say, I've been thinking about this and worrying about what the proper mechanism was, until one day it dawned on me at about 5 o'clock in the morning when I woke up early, and there was the answer sitting right in front of me. But I did want to acknowledge that I'm sure one of the subliminal aspects of that was my knowledge of the work of Young and Winstein, who had just very recently before that explained the stereochemistry of some chlorhydrin reactions by bromonium intermediates, cyclic bromonium ions. And certainly if bromine could participate in such a thing, sulfur ought to be a lot better. So it seemed, you can ask why did it take me so long to come to this idea, but it did take a couple of weeks before I got the explanation. It fit everything beautifully. And so we went to the next meeting of our NDRC subcommittee, and I was all prepared to announce that I'd solved the problem of what the mechanism of this reaction was. Paul Bartlett got up to report earlier, and he had just come to the conclusion that nitrogen mustard went through cyclic ammonium ion. So we actually, independently, within a span of a few weeks of each other, had come to the conclusion that in each case the key intermediate was the intermediate three-membered ring, the intermediate ammonium ion for the nitrogen mustards and sulfonium for the sulfur mustards. So, but it did explain everything, and later evidence was presented that you get rearrangements that you predict if the sulfonium intermediate was formed when you had asymmetrically substituted beta chloro alkyl sulfide. So I think everybody agrees that that's the case. In the sulfur mustard cases, I don't think anybody has ever been able to isolate the intermediate. It's much more reactive.
Yeah.
And later work, we went to working in cancer chemotherapy work with diethyl chloroethyl amine. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the cyclic ammonium is stable enough to use as a reagent. It cyclizes in solution and hydrolyzes 1% in a week. So we just used the cyclic intermediate there. So there's a great difference in the stability of those cyclic intermediates. And the sulfur mustard, I don't think anybody has ever been able to prove by isolating it, as they have in the case of some of the nitrogen mustards. But that was kind of exciting. And Saul Winstein was always kind of miffed, I think, that we'd come to these conclusions during the war. before he came up with his idea of Ancomeric assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are ideal examples of Ancomeric assistance, and of course he invented the term Ancomeric assistance to explain other kinds of reactions. But and Paul and I both talked about this at that Notre Dame Mechanism Symposium.
I see.
Saul was.
That's the first time that he knew
about this.
I see. He wasn't involved in that.
He was not involved in that. I don't know what kind of war work he did. He was. He must have done something, I assume, but I don't know. He was not involved, to my knowledge, at all in the mustard run. So he was not familiar with what had gone on.
I see.
I think that symposium was his first exposure to the fact that Paul and I had both come up with it.
You mentioned that. I wonder do you remember any more details of his finding that out, or you just talked about it at the time, and you just remember his surprise and maybe
surprise and slight annoyance at the fact that I suppose he might have suspected that we would try to claim more credit than we weren't trying to steal anybody's credit for anything, but we had done it independently of him, but not entirely, because certainly, and at least in my case, I was well aware, I'm sure Paul Bartlett was well aware of that very classic work that Saul did for his PhD with Bill Young on the cyclic bromonium intermediates. I mean, that was classic, and that was a greater jump of the imagination than cyclic sulfonium and ammonium ions, because bromonium ions were not nearly as common a kind of thing to think about. I guess at that time only iodonium ions were actually known as isolable species, let alone cyclic ones.
That sort of covers a lot of that material. I was really very excited, and I think it seemed to be a revelation for both of us in a way that the war had drawn attention to physical organic chemistry and who practiced it, and this had a great deal to do with the crystallization of the physical organic community and its later success. How were those war problems assigned, and do you remember how you happened to be working on the anti-malarial project and that water treatment project?
I'm not sure that I have any kind of real recollection of how that went. But I believe Roger Adams was very high up in the NDRC operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Speed Marvel was also very much involved in the upper levels of policy and decision making.
Yeah.
And I really should remember better how the anti-malarial work got started. It really wasn't something I was into.
Yes,
heterocyclic synthesis.
That was sort of out of your.
But I did get involved in it, and I was and I had two other profs working with me. But it was initially my project, and then Harold Snyder joined in, and then Nelson Leonard joined in. So I had two, so we had a good team working on it. And I just don't remember how that actually got started and channeled to me. It's rather ridiculous, I remember. But the water thing was...
You were about to say the water treatment work, you thought...
There was in the chemistry department was the Illinois Water Treatment Center, and one of the professors there was the director of it, Arthur Buswell. And so they had gotten involved, again, I imagine through Roger Adams, in the water problem. And they obviously needed some extra help on the chemistry involved in these things in water. And since I was the mechanisms man in Illinois at that time, I got drafted to work with them. And I set up originally a sub-project under Buswell to work on the mechanism of reaction of chemical warfare agents in water. and we had a very interesting group. Orville Bullitt Jr. was one of the guys, came complete with wife and maid, not quite a chauffeur, but Orville Bullitt was a very wealthy family here in town.
I see.
And the other, another guy that worked on that was Al Poland, who later became the inventor of Darvon, which is now in the news a bit. So we had some interesting people working on those problems. I think Bernie Belson also. We had a good team. And then finally, Buswell went off to some other. I think he actually joined the military as a reserve officer.
Mm-hmm.
So I inherited the whole project. Had guys with a pilot plant water treatment outfit. We had to learn all about carbon black, and I visited all kinds of carbon black manufacturers, the right kind of carbon black, and we designed a little kit that would be sent out in the field for analysis for chemical, all kinds of different chemical warfare agents. So I had those two major programs that were under my aegis, the one on antimalarial drugs and the one on water treatment. It's the one on water treatment that got me involved in mechanisms.
Yeah.
A drug was a pretty straight synthetic organic.
The fact that you did do the physical organic chemistry of it, was that sort of a side product, or you felt it was important to understand the problem?
I thought
or
it was essential.
Yeah.
If you're going to try to cope with these reagents in water, you've got to know what's going to happen with them in water.
Okay.
So we had to know what happened to them in water and what happened to them when you treated with chlorine.
Mm-hmm.
We got involved in the oxidation and degradation. I learned some very interesting things. We found out that nitrogen mustard, which is a tertiary amine, is rapidly degraded by chlorine water. And I thought this was pretty original, but we found out eventually when we looked deep in the literature that some old gent a long time ago found out when you chlorinate trimethylamine, chlorine goes on the nitrogen first, apparently, to give a quaternary. Then it leases HCl to give a quaternary shift base. Then that hydrolyzes to give formaldehyde and dimethylamine. And then the dimethylamine can become a chloramine,
and that
split out HCl and give the shift base of methylamine and formaldehyde. And so you can eventually take all the alkyl groups off of nitrogen by that mechanism, destroying hypochlorite in the process. So, when you're going to be treating chemical warfare agent, water that might contain chemical warfare agents, you A, have to know what happens to it when it's just sitting in the water, and B, you have to know what it's going to do with the typical water treatment materials. So we had to do a lot of chemistry on it.
But in a sense, you weren't just worrying about the products and the starting materials, as I think one might have done in an earlier era. You were sort of understanding the reactions.
Yes. I suppose the fact that was my interest made me more conscious of doing it that way than I would have if I'd been a pure.
So it wasn't really hard to justify what you were doing in terms of. I mean, they were interested in results, but you know, you were approaching work in that way as long as you turned out results. Now the antimalarial program was essentially a synthetic program.
Yes, that was mainly to make quinolone analogs of chloroquine, and we did a few other kinds of things, but that was the main thrust of our efforts.
You did later patent some of
We patented some syntheses, the ethoxymethylene malonic ester synthesis, which Roy Roberts worked on. We patented through the government-owned patent, and it was used commercially. At least a modest scale, and we got very much involved in that. I guess I went out to National Anilin up in Buffalo at least once a month while they did the pilot plant work on developing that synthesis. It had a big advantage over the German synthesis. I've forgotten the exact details of the German synthesis, but it started with metachloroanilin, and they got a mixture of 5 and 7 chloro nucleus.
Yes.
Closed in either of two ways. The ethoxymethylene closed almost exclusively to give 7, almost 0.5. It was a much neater, cleaner synthesis, economically competitive. And so the government patented it, and it was used to some extent for sometime after the war as a way to make War 7 DICOR equivalent. Roy Roberts, of course, now professor of Texas.
Yes, he went to, I noticed he went to Merck.
He made it, that's right, for a while. He had a rather remarkable academic record. He went through college and university without any mark anywhere on his curriculum except an A.
And he just did everything at Illinois, or did he?
No, he did his undergraduate work at Austin College in Texas. College in Texas, Sherman College. It was in Sherman, Texas, Austin College in Sherman, Texas. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. For some reason, I didn't write down that work on the alkylation using optically active
secondary butyl alcohol.
That's right.
Marion Lund.
Yes. Yeah. I thought that was sort of fascinating. And the fact that you came up with an optically active product using one catalyst, and that still holds true.
That was confirmed, I think, by Burwell.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the alcohol and boron fluoride ether, boron fluoride, we got an optically active secondary butyl benzene with inversion. It was something like 99.something% racemization.
Mm-hmm.
So. But fit with a carbonium ion, but with a slight preference for inversion.
That seemed to be a very, what's the word I want to use? It was a very up-to-date analysis that you made at that time, so you really must have been very aware of the kinds of mechanisms you could get into with Lewis catalysts.
I've always been one of the people's minds have different ways of working, and mine has always been very geometrically and sterically oriented. Geometry was always just a toy for me in school. Uh-huh. I just had no troubles with it at all. And of course, I did a lot of geometric analysis and calculating those electrical interactions because you had to do that geometry to get the nature of electrical distances between charges and whatnot. So I've always been handy with geometry and steric factors, and then when Roger went off to Washington, most of the time I taught his course in stereochemistry, which was a very easy thing for me to do, and I've always felt very much at home with steric effects and stereochemistry.
That reminds me, I wanted to ask you, what courses did you teach at Illinois during the years you were there? Do you remember what you started out teaching?
Well, I started out teaching the elementary organic course for the pre-meds and home ecs.
Mm-hmm. That's right, I think we mentioned that the other day. Right.
I taught that for quite a few years. And the other two courses that I taught there mainly were advanced course that Adams taught to graduate students on stereochemistry,
mm-hmm.
and the other course that I taught, which included a lot of more than just stereochemistry. It involved all the stereochemistry and chemistry of sugars.
Mm-hmm.
Anything when there was stereochemistry, it involved the chemistry as well as the stereochemistry, so it was a fairly broad gauge course. And the other course that I taught quite frequently was the qual-organic course, the Schweiner and Huisson.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
But during your stay there, you didn't introduce a theoretical organic or a physical organic course. Do you know if a course like that was taught?
I don't think we got around to doing that while I was there. We did as soon as I got to Notre Dame, but during the war, there was a lot of pressure on the research we were doing, and there wasn't too much chance for renovation of the curriculum. We just kind of went through what we had,
right.
And I left essentially at the end of 45. My new job at Notre Dame began in January of 46, so the war had hardly been over before I left to go to Notre Dame.
How did you happen to pick up and go? Was the job offered? Were you
around? It was I'd had a couple of jobs offered to me in Pittsburgh and I think in Missouri, which I didn't really consider very seriously, although it was a great place to work. Mm-hmm. And Father Moore, the dean of the graduate school, and two professors came down from Notre Dame to talk to me about going up to Notre Dame and the possibility of becoming chairman of the department. And I really, having turned down Pittsburgh and Missouri, I kind of thought this was a joke, but I had the typical opinion about Notre Dame that it was just a football school.
I was just thinking, maybe they came after you because of your football background.
And so I really didn't take it very seriously, but I'd never been there. So I thought, well, hell, I might as well go and look at the place. And I was tremendously impressed with the beautiful campus they had. And Father Moore was just an absolutely superb human being, very high academic standards. And, of course, chemistry was the best department Notre Dame had. Father Newland had pioneered there and some work that had brought in a lot of royalties. So they've been able to invest a fair amount. I learned also that contrary to Illinois, where all the football receipts went only to athletics, at Notre Dame, they helped pay the bill for academics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they actually had a very sensible policy about athletics. They wanted to be good, but they certainly didn't have a bunch of basket weaving courses and things like that to get their athletes in. Hart was an engineer, mm-hmm. and a good one. He had a B average. The captain one year when I was there was a chem engineer. First string tackle one year was taking my organic course as a senior. He wanted to be an MD, and so he quit playing football. Make sure you get decent enough grades to get him in med school. Nobody put any pressure on him. Mm-hmm. It was his choice. And So I was impressed with the place, and besides, they did offer me the job as head of the chemistry department, and I was ambitious enough to think that was interesting, especially since I was the youngest member of the department. So I went there as chairman and the youngest member of the department, and I enjoyed it there. It was, by and large, a very interesting place to work. We got a new building built. Got some pretty good people in there. Ernest Eliel was my first acquisition, and I think a damn good one.
Yeah. He was not a student of yours.
He was a student of Harold Snyder's at Illinois.
Okay.
I hadn't actually known Ernest. He wasn't the first one, but that's wrong. Yeah, I guess I didn't hire him until about 3 or 4 years after that, because I did not know Ernest. He must have come in about 47 or 8. He got to Illinois in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Had about 5 papers. And apparently, Harold said, also was the advisor to most of the other students in the department. Ernest is a very smart guy. No, he wasn't the first guy. Paul Doty was one of the first ones I hired. Paul was a very interesting character. And another one that I hired at the Fair Den and things was,
Just Paul Doty, that was the biochemist who ended up at Harvard. It's D-O-T-Y.
D-O-T-Y, Paul Doty. Yeah, actually, he spent almost a month debating whether to leave Notre Dame to go to Harvard. I was very pleased that he didn't, just snap that job.
Right.
But he liked it at Notre Dame. Uh-huh. And then Milton Burton, who was pretty well known for his work in radiation chemistry, and started the radiation labs at Notre Dame, which are now
See, we were talking about Notre Dame, and
I just had mentioned that Milton Harris was a Milton Burton had been one of the ones that we brought on there. We got Notre Dame involved in radiation chemistry and set up the radiation lab there. So it was an interesting job, and I enjoyed it. I'm sure it added distractions to my scientific endeavors. but I still managed to publish quite a few papers.
Yes, I think it was 46, I counted something of the order of 21 papers and 47, which there was a lot of war work.
Some of that
work,
was a backlog of
war. Yeah, it was war work, but there were quite a few papers for the next several years. The years at Illinois are sort of involved with the war work as well as your own research ideas. But who were you talking to at Illinois? Who were your closest colleagues when you wanted to talk chemistry? Who did you talk to, both at Illinois and outside of Illinois?
Well, I suppose that I talked more to chemists outside of Illinois than I did in, because there weren't too many people that were interested. Jack Roberts, I know, I've had many mm-hmm. discussions with. I had arguments with Saul Winstein. I can't place the exact time of these, whether it was before the end of the war, after the end of the war, but in the 40s, I'm sure I had lots of discussions with those people like Herb Brown. I know I had many talks with. I'm a great admirer of Herb Brown.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you recommended that I look at a 1951 paper, which was sort of a reevaluation of the electrostatic effects and some new calculations that you had made. And the interesting thing was that the last paragraph of the paper, there's comment on something that you attribute to Herb Brown, and I think that later turned out to be called the Hammond postulate. And it was just so clear. I looked at that, and I was.
I've been a little annoyed about how many things I originated that later somebody else christened and took credit for.
Yeah.
I mean, no mechanism reactions. That's all over my carbon-carbon double bond book. Mm-hmm. Nobody bothered to mention it, but we were one of the very first ones to ever suggest this cyclic reaction mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Pi complexes were suggested in that book before mm-hmm. Michael Dewar, and he has given me credit for being one of the first ones, the mm-hmm. first to postulate that.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, I didn't have the magic touch of inventing a name or something like that that caught people's imagination.
Yeah.
But I'm interested that you happen to notice that.
Yeah, it just.
I did have a lot of original ideas.
It struck me so clearly, and it was apparent that you were talking to Herb Brown at that time. I guess he wasn't so far off either. Did at any time did you feel you were competing with other chemists on particular problems? Was there some particular problem that you felt you were in a race to come up with an answer for at any given time?
I guess I've never really had that feeling about my research that mm-hmm. I had to beat somebody else out of something. I do remember very consciously on many occasions feeling a little discouraged about chemistry. Why wasn't I getting more done? Why didn't I have...
Yeah.
And I used to then console myself by thinking about what all the other guys were doing, finally coming out feeling a little better.
Yes, it's invariably so. When somebody else says, gee, it's going very slowly, you feel better about that. Had Elliot Alexander come to Illinois before
no,
you?
No, he was essentially my replacement
I see.
At Illinois, okay. But I knew him. Mm-hmm. He was a Swarthmore graduate.
Mm-hmm.
I remember playing squash with him a few times when he was still... I think he worked at DuPont for a year or two after he got his degree.
Okay. I haven't traced his career. I think he got his degree at Columbia with Cope. And Cope was only there during the war years. I don't even know if he was ever officially listed. I guess he was officially listed on the Columbia faculty, but must have been one of the few students he had at Columbia. I think that's
I think
story.
That's right, but I think he then worked at least a few years, maybe during the end of after Elliot got his degree, he worked a year or two or three maybe at DuPont.
I see. Mm-hmm.
because I remember playing squash with him down at the Y in Wilmington.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to be very good friends. He's a wonderful, he and his wife were just absolutely super human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a great terrible tragedy when he got killed so young. But he essentially came to be my replacement in Illinois when I left. But I saw a lot of him. We met at meetings and played tennis. And I remember playing tennis with him up at the Organic Symposium in Northwestern shortly after the war. Life was...